This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another interview on the New Books Network. I'm very pleased to be here. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I have with me the author of a fascinating book published by MIT Press titled Lifelines of Our Society, A Global History of Infrastructure. This is an important book and an interesting book that looks at something that's really important to our everyday life all over the world, but maybe isn't examined that often. So I'm very pleased to have with us the author of the book, Dr. Dirk van Lock, to tell us all about this book. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm glad you said yes. Before we get into the book, though, would you mind introducing yourself a bit and explaining why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So my name is Dirk van Lock, and I'm from Germany, and I have spent several decades now on this topic of infrastructure. I'm a historian of profession, historian of modern age or recent times or contemporary history, and I came across this topic in the 1990s, around the 1990s, and when we detected not just myself, but a couple of people, how important infrastructures are for everyday life, that they actually shape and form it, our everyday pattern of behavior, and are crucially important for economy, for society, for our culture. And then we embarked on doing historical research on it, and after having done that for two or three decades, I just decided that I should try to summarize what we found out and others found out. And so I decided around 10 years ago to write that book, and I had to prepare for certain conditions to be able to write the book. That took a while, but then I got it ready in almost 5 years ago, and now I have the opportunity to also read it in English.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that background with us. It's always helpful to know sort of how someone comes to a project. If we think then about the subject of the book, of paying attention to infrastructure, what paradoxes do you think are revealed by paying attention to infrastructure in this way?
Well, there are several paradoxes, actually. So one major paradox is perhaps that you quickly discover the importance of infrastructures for our lives, but that you on a daily basis really do not mind and do not think about infrastructure so much. So in a way, they are not very present. And this is one major paradox. Maybe this is what they are meant for, because they want to set us kind of free for other things, for more creative things to do and to think about, than to ask, where comes our water from, and how can I get electricity, and how can I manage to switch on or switch off lights, and this always is cared for by experts and by systems, and we rely on availability and supplies and provisions. This makes our life more rich and more comfortable. And this is one of the paradoxes that also it's not very very much researched by historians how that came into reality. Another paradox may be that we also do not take into account how much we are formatted in our daily life in our routines and our habits by infrastructures. So we are socialized into a kind of second nature world that is full of provisions that we have to adopt to, that we have to perceive intellectually, and that we have to use, and that means that we have to be on time, that we have to learn a lot from cradle to the grave, that we have to learn, for instance, to behave properly when we go out and use traffic or drive by car or whatever. So these are perhaps the two major paradoxes that are connected to the infrastructure complex.
Thank you for introducing them to us. They raise a lot of issues I think we will get into more. Going through then that history of infrastructure presented in this book, starting at the earlier phase, can you help us understand what role English canals played in moving the world to a globalized economy?
Well, yes. Actually, in my narrative, started with the English canal system because it appeared to me to be a kind of a starting point for the modern infrastructure complex, the basis for a diversified and fossil fuel-driven economy that we are living in until today. The basis for modern circulation and exchange of people, of goods, of energies and ideas. And in a certain way, the canal system, because it was used for delivering coal and getting food everywhere to the British countryside and to the cities. And it was, in this sense, it was also a kind of starting point for what we today call the Anthropocene, for it laid the foundations for our present economy, expecting always to improve and to expand, and mostly, as we have found out today, at the cost of natural resources or at the cost of non-European societies.
That makes a good starting point then for us to begin with. Obviously, the history moves on and we won't cover every single thing that's in the book, unfortunately. But I'd love to ask you about sort of a next big one, at least from my reading, which is about the history of the telephone. How can we see the history of the telephone as perhaps a great example of the larger picture, the rise of electrical infrastructure?
Yeah, well, jumping to the telephone, of course, omits the role of railways, which was very crucial in the 19th century for the infrastructure complex and for industrialization on the whole. But, well, the telephone especially is a good example for a new device that was invented by very different engineers in different countries, and it was kind of collective invention, to say so, by engineers who had very different intentions to reach with their inventions, and it is also a good example for the fact that inventions like the telephone or electricity often had problems to get started and to get involved involved into the everyday life of people, because initially they were not admired very much. The fields of usage for telephones had actually to be invented somehow. By marketing advertising. And we have some research about how telephone in the end succeeded. That was mainly by the fact that women adopted the telephone in the United States, for instance, with a large spatial conditions, and women were actually addressed to keep track via telephones of their husbands and their children, or to stay in contact with each other's with other women. And then slowly it became more common to have a telephone, actually, whereas before that was a device used by enterprises only and not so much by private people. So we can detect with the telephones kind of trickle-down effects that from very exclusive usages, a thing becomes very common and becomes adopted by a lot of people because they had adopted a clue, an idea for how that could be good or could be necessary. But adopting telephones and infrastructures in general often is accompanied by being instructed for a proper use. And we can also see that with a telephone, that people initially were not too sure about how to use the telephone and when to or how to dial, how to get a connection. in time, how long they should speak, in what way they should speak to get heard the best, and how to use it effectively. This is especially true for public telephones, of course, who will often rivaled to get to. So and slowly telephone became very common and very normal to make appointments with other people. So in a way, slowly it became a normal device that very many people got used to and could no longer recall how it was possible to live without a telephone.
I think the idea of kind of being instructed to use something, seeing how it might be possible, is really interesting to think about. And in some ways, that relates to the next thing I'd like to ask you about, which is, why are or were high-end hotels, fancy hotels, such a good site to look at to understand the history of infrastructure?
Yeah, I found out that these high-end hotels are very good examples to see how places of how they turned into places to test maximums of luxury for the people, in offering comfort for the people, and that often included that they were kind of avant-garde in adopting infrastructures and modern technologies, new technologies, and these hotels, who knew each other, of course, very well on a worldwide basis, they often tried to outperform each other by offering the highest possible amount of comfort. And that had some good effects, of course, for people being able to pay for this, but it also has some disadvantages because technologies always replaced employees and staff and people by these technologies. And there is also another kind of paradox connected especially to hotels in context of tourism, because in these hotels things are expected to look very easy and authentic and very local, but they also are expected to function very smoothly, very comfortably, and everywhere in the same way, which requires a bunch of technologies and a bunch of infrastructures. So these are very ambivalent places to do research on infrastructures, their positive and their negative effects. And there are many ambivalences that we can see today.
Mm. No, thank you for that. A very good illustration of the idea of infrastructure being so important, but we don't think about it. I think in hotels, that's not what we might be usually considering. As you mentioned, though, in that answer, infrastructure in some cases is meant to be visible, is meant to be noticed, right? Is meant to give you a sense of quality or luxury. And if we look back, for example, to the early 1900s, a lot of everyday infrastructure was decorated, was cool looking, was meant to be noticed. But infrastructure today, you know, pipes, pumping stations, telephone boxes, are not meant to be decorated or noticeable. When and why did infrastructure stop being something we were meant to look at?
Yeah, well, this actually is one of the miracles of infrastructure history. Why is infrastructure today often so sober, so banal? Not very pretty. And one explanation may be that in the 19th century, infrastructure, the new technologies often were evidences of urban pride, and they were modeled after medieval or pre-modern architecture to actually impress citizens of the cities and visitors of the cities alike. So they were designed as becoming a landmark and actually a place to visit and be proud of. And this changed for different reasons in the early 20th century and up to today. First, because design was too expensive, became too expensive for the many infrastructures that we have. And then it also became, in a way, after the experiences of two world wars, it was clear that too visible infrastructures was also very vulnerable and had a critical nature as target of terrorism or as targets during wars. Another reason may be that, or that may be another reason for the fact that most of modern infrastructure has been hidden and has been placed in a kind of second city below the surfaces of modern cities and also in the landscapes.
Mm. Thank you for helping us understand that. I think it's a big change to notice and useful to get some clarity on. If we stay in that early 20th century time, especially after the First World War, one might expect infrastructure and socialism to very much go together. But you discuss in your book that they don't fuse seamlessly. Why not?
Yeah, this is another miracle that I cannot explain in total. But part of the explanation may be that usually one should have expected in theory that infrastructure and socialism would have matched perfectly, because both stress the common good of public infrastructure. Both evoke an integrated and sometimes also an egalitarian society. But both didn't take the human nature into account insofar that individuals also like to stress differences among themselves. So infrastructure is open to different kinds of usages for the common good and for individual distinction. So when socialist societies who actually try to avoid the term infrastructure for a lot of many decades and just adopted it during the 1970s and 1980s, but in the end, they implemented almost as much infrastructure as the Western liberal societies, especially in the time after the Second World War. However, they remained, this is one part of the explanation, they remained in the first and the second phase of modern industrialization, which is heavy industry, chemical industry and electric industry, and they were not successful. They didn't manage to enter into the third or even the fourth phase being marked, of industrialization being marked by a turn to services and digitization. So, strangely enough, I also nourish the thesis that socialism in that kind, as it existed in Eastern Europe, wouldn't have survived actually the era of digitization very, very, very long.
Hmm. Interesting. Thank you for explaining that to us, even without necessarily knowing everything. That's still really interesting and helpful to think through. One aspect I'd love to ask you about from the book is, of course, the idea that infrastructure enables governments to be involved in more areas of people's daily lives. There's obviously many ways in which infrastructure does this, but are there any in particular, maybe that are lesser known but very important, that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, well, it appeared to me while dealing with infrastructure that that it is a kind of a substitute or used as a substitute for other kinds of politics, for more open kinds of politics. So governing people by technology, if I may say so, because infrastructure promises to give something to everybody and to make life better, to improve prosperity and things like that. So in official rhetoric of politicians, you often find hints to where we have to improve and we have to invest into our future by investing into infrastructure, by implementing new technologies and things like that. So this is a very common common form of political rhetoric. Almost all political parties are in favor for infrastructure and demand more of it, which is kind of strange, isn't it? I'm not completely done with explaining why this is actually the fact and how it came that almost no group within modern society is opposing modern infrastructure. It still has this notion of being neutral, being good, being for the common good. And nobody arguing, well, infrastructure is also a kind of a subtle or not very open means of disciplining people and governing them and placing them and controlling them. There was a little more talk today by environmentalists and people being sensitive for modern ecological questions, and they have another view or other views on the infrastructure complex, which I think is necessary to get, because the modern the infrastructure complex that we are living in a way, has disciplined us in a way that makes it very difficult to come out of it and to reorient another politics.
Mm. Are there any particular examples of infrastructure in that sense that you'd like to mention?
You mean new infrastructures or?
Ones that police, that discipline in ways that are hard to get out of.
Yeah, well, there are people talking of kind of mental infrastructures, and what they mean is this, that we have been formatted mentally to expect things to function, or so things or the facilities around us to function and to be maintained by experts so that we don't have to care for themselves. And so we have been educated in a way to expect things getting better, things being cared for us, and this is a format of thinking that is kind of calculable for politicians. It's very calculable for the consumer economy that we're living in, and we are so difficult to get out and to distance. So maybe that's part of the answer, but it's also a huge question. I mean, a lot of environmentalists try to solve and try to tackle.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Thank you for kind of putting it on the table, as it were. Another aspect of infrastructure you discuss in the book is that some infrastructure systems have second lives that do things after what they were initially meant to do. Can you take us through maybe one or two examples of interesting second lives that infrastructure systems might have had?
Yes. Well, the basic realization is that all infrastructures have some kind of life circle, that they have, that they age, they have a starting point, they grow and they flourish, but they also get older and get into decay. And some of them have certain reinvention as being used in a kind of second life. So these second lives often come from first the durability of installed infrastructures, and second from the past dependency of implemented infrastructures. That means that infrastructures once implemented continue certain traces and trails. And to come back to the English canal system, it for instance became or had a second reinvention as tourist hubs, or a lot of former railway tracks from the 19th century that are not used any longer became bicycle highways in recent years, or former water pipelines turned into tubes containing different lines, electricity mains, or telephone wires, or I don't know, lines for modern internet. So there are a couple of examples for the reusage of former infrastructures that is used once again, that has a second life, and people reinventing that.
Absolutely fascinating. I think anyone listening might look at infrastructure after this differently, going, what might the second life of that be? Or the thing that I'm, the trail I'm walking on now, maybe this had a first life as something in infrastructure. So that idea alone, I think, is really interesting. As we move towards the end, thinking about the whole research and writing process of the book, what do you think are some of the most interesting ways to you that infrastructure has changed everyday life?
Well, as I've indicated before, also my starting point was to assess the importance of infrastructure for everyday life. Our thesis is that infrastructure has created a kind of second nature that fits human needs, that supplies basic resources, but also, on the other hand, makes us very dependent from these provisions. And this is also a fact that alerts and alarms all people that care for human security because of its vulnerability and its critical nature. And what is fascinating is the almost complete penetration of our everyday life by infrastructures of all kinds today, the way in which we have been formed and disciplined by these facilities and their proper use. We are trained and socialized from cradle to grave, I indicated that before, to fit in or to catch up to these socio-technological complexities, which none of our ancestors actually have ever dreamt of.
No, very good point. As my final question, obviously, you mentioned at the beginning, this book is something you worked on for quite a long time, and of course, has a new life now coming out in English. Is there any other projects, any of your other work, either current or future, you'd like to tell our audience a little bit about?
Yes, very quickly. My next topic that I will devote my next time, my next years to is, it has to do with infrastructures in certain ways. It's an attempt to sum up situations in which the so-called kleine Leute were spoken of or appealed to, a term which is not easily translated into English, for common man in English is not the same as a little man or little woman in German. But it's an interesting social figure or social type that has specific functions in political parlance, in social analysis, and also in cultural representations. And I'm going to write something on not less than the last 200 years of coming to terms with this little man, trying to identify him, dress him, and also to govern him. So this is my next project.
That sounds interesting. Thank you for sharing that preview with us. And of course, while you're working on that project, listeners can read the book we've been discussing in English titled Lifelines of Our Society, A Global History of Infrastructure, published by MIT Press in 2023. Dirk, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Miranda, thank you very much.